18. In late 2018, it was time for Mattis to fill several important four-star jobs in the military. A complicated minuet of recommending the right general or admiral for the job best suited to their strengths and particular responsibilities. It had to be elegantly orchestrated. Mattis had one focus. Who best to lead if there was a war? Mattis probably knew more about actual fighting of wars, about life in the infantry with bullets flying, on ships at sea for months at a time, and planes loaded with bombs and missiles, than any recent Secretary of Defense. General Joe Dunford was retiring as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Mattis had the perfect candidate to replace him as the number one military man and chief military advisor to the president. The chairman could be a potent force in a time of war, as General Colin Powell had demonstrated when he served as chairman during the first Gulf War in 1991, one of the most sensible, short, and relatively low casualty wars of all time. Powell, a Vietnam veteran, had pushed for an overwhelming force of 500,000 U.S. military personnel in the operation in order to get in, get out, and protect as many soldiers as possible. Mattis had been a 41-year-old lieutenant colonel then, commanding a battalion of 1,250 in the blistering heat of the Saudi desert. They spent 5 months preparing for the mission to eject Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard from Kuwait. Mattis lost 20 pounds. His superiors estimated that half of his troops would be either killed or wounded while breaching the Iraqi lines, a staggering prospect. Mattis rehearsed his troops non-stop, teaching them to maintain momentum at all costs and to improvise. No days off, no television, no phones. During the training, the fastest breach had taken 21 minutes. In actual combat, it took 11 minutes. Extraordinarily, none of his Marines were killed in the fight. Without reservation, Mattis wanted Fingers, Air Force Chief of Staff David L. Goldfein, to be the new chairman. Fingers was Goldfein's call sign because of the mastery of cockpit controls he'd developed over 4,200 flying hours across six types of aircraft. At 58, he was skilled, young, vigorous, humble, and the most proven strategic thinker. He would bring a level of intellectualism to the job that the president had resisted. When Mattis had been CENTCOM commander in the Middle East, Fingers had been the Air Force component commander for 2 years. He had performed brilliantly and was probably the most joint Air Force general Mattis had ever seen, meaning he demonstrated an ability to look beyond the capabilities of his own service and find ways to integrate with and complement others. For example, when Fingers arrived in 2011, U.S. aircraft carriers would sail through the dangerous Iran-controlled Strait of Hormuz with their only air cover provided by Navy planes, standard service-on-service parochialism. Fingers soon had Air Force F-15s and F-16s escorting the carriers and teed up helicopters and F-18s on the carrier deck, ready to launch. Between the constant fighters overhead and the F-18s on the carrier, the Iranian Republican Guard soon began to fade away. It was a classic case of flooding the zone, the airspace, as well as increased readiness and training. Mattis knew he could work well with Fingers. When Mattis had tasked him with reorganizing the war plan for the Gulf and Iran, Fingers took Mattis's guidance and cited Eisenhower's advice. If a problem can't be solved easily, make it bigger. As Mattis put it, if the Iranians had a 29-inch reach, he wanted a 30-inch reach. And Fingers had given it to him, expanding the airspace so the American air power had a greater reach than the Iranians. Fingers was cunning, accepted guidance, and had well prepared CENTCOM for possible war. Just as meaningful to Mattis, Fingers had been shot down in an F-16 over Bosnia in 1999. He knew that coming face to face with your own mortality changed the way you look at the world, at war, and at yourself. Mattis also had to find a new NATO commander. Given Trump's ceaseless criticism of NATO, he thought Army Chief of Staff Mark Milley would be the best. Mattis considered him a loud optimist. The New York Times would later call him a general who mixes bluntness and banter. In June 2018, Trump had praised Milley for being good at pricing bombs as well as throwing them. Mattis thought Milley would both appeal to Trump and infuse NATO with the needed self-confidence, bolstering the alliance. Under Mattis, the Army had many changes to make and needed to gut many now irrelevant programs. Milley oversaw a methodical improvement in Army brigade readiness, bringing the number deemed immediately combat ready up from 3 to 30, a remarkable improvement. Milley also improved the physical fitness of the Army, an issue of immense importance to Mattis. It was humiliating to watch the U.S. Army march in a parade and then go watch the Mexican Army or the Ukrainian Army or the Norwegians, Mattis said. The armies of other nations were so much more fit. He concluded that a third of the Army was overweight or obese. It was appalling. Milley had aggressively raised Army physical fitness. Mattis recommended Fingers to Trump to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Army Chief Milley to take over the NATO command. The Defense Secretary's recommendations for these top military posts were almost always accepted by the President. But David Urban, a lawyer, lobbyist, and early Trump supporter who had helped Trump win the crucial state of Pennsylvania in 2016, weighed in with the President directly. Urban, a West Point graduate, advocated that Milley, instead of Goldfein, be made chairman. Pompeo, another West Pointer, also recommended Milley. Trump quickly offered the top job to Milley, who accepted. Questions would linger on how Milley earned the chairmanship and whether he was too accommodating to Trump. Mattis thought it hurt Milley's reputation because it looked too much like raw politics. Mattis was sure Milley's fellow Joint Chiefs would not have chosen him as chairman. His style was too brash, but the other chiefs, of course, did not have a vote. Mattis did not protest Trump's decision. "I wasn't paid to express my exasperation," Mattis told an associate. The damage was done. Mattis believed he had not really been given a shot because of the president's preemptive, impetuous decision-making. The military and the country would lose Goldfein's leadership, although he stayed on as Air Force Chief of Staff. Milley was more than acceptable. Having a bond with the president might help. It also, though, might make it harder for Milley to stand up to the president, increasingly a central part of the job of chairman. Mattis realized that, more than ever, he and Trump were not hitting it off. But Mattis felt he was still winning more than he was losing. Behind the scenes, he continued to make gains on military readiness, budget, and training. He was focused inwardly on his relationships with Pompeo, Coates, and CIA Director Haspel. Trump's problem extended further to the president's failure to build a smooth working team, to listen, gather various informed opinions, debate, identify options, debate some more, and bring everyone on board with a decision. "I consider myself the most reluctant person on earth to go to war," Mattis wrote in his 2019 book on leadership. But it had to be asked. What might it mean if a war came and the best person was not in the chairmanship? Suppose the great military leaders of World War II had been cast aside on the impulse of the commander-in-chief. In that environment, would there have been an Eisenhower or Marshall or MacArthur or Nimitz or Halsey? And what would have been the price paid for not having them there? The answer, of course, was unknowable. But it was important to address the issue of succession. Every large organization or business had a responsibility to make sure there was a process for finding the very best. And in 2018, Mattis believed the commander-in-chief had failed and let the country down. Mattis had long detested and distrusted Iran. In 1983, Lebanese terrorists, later determined to be acting at the direction of Iran, drove 2 truck bombs into the Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. Those killed included 220 Marines and 21 other military personnel. Mattis, at the time a major assigned as the executive officer at the Naval Academy Preparatory School in Rhode Island, was tasked with making casualty calls in Rhode Island. First, he visited 7 families to tell them their sons were missing. Then he returned several days later. "Your son has been found," he had to report. "He's dead. And no, you can't have an open casket." In 2013, after being fired by Obama, Mattis returned to Richland, Washington, a civilian, for the first time in over 4 decades. Over the years, he had written more than 800 letters to the families of those who had died under his command. These were the Gold Star families. He would often get replies from the families asking him to come see them. Or someone in the fallen Marine's unit would forward a copy of a handwritten note or letter. Mattis would have someone investigate to make sure it was authentic, and if so, would forward it to the family with a note from him. "Here's what we found out about your son or husband." Often the family would then say, "Please come see us." Then, with time on his hands, Mattis hit the road in his light brown 1998 Lexus sedan. He would stop to speak at organized groups of veterans or Gold Star families or to an individual family. He would pull into a town, get a hotel room, read the folder about the fallen Marine or soldier, put on a suit, and go pay his respects. Sometimes this led him to a mobile home, sometimes to the home of a very wealthy family. He especially remembered a visit to a family in Utah with a large, beautiful home. He drove up a winding hill. Inside, he took a seat. Tall windows fronted the house. The father, a doctor, was home early. The mother, a professor at a local college, had perfectly painted nails and every hair just right. They were stoic. Their son had a 4-year college football scholarship, but had joined the Marines instead. He had died in combat years earlier. The mother talked about their deceased son, the mountains he had climbed. They took Mattis to a boy's bedroom, still fully intact, preserved almost as a museum. They showed Mattis all the pictures, their son as a baby, grammar school, high school, the prom, the full American story. Mattis could only listen so long. There was only so much to say. After an hour, the visit was petering out. The mother said General Stanley McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, had asked for 40,000 more troops in 2009, and President Obama had given 30,000. She had her history correct. If there were more, 1 million troops available, she asked, why didn't McChrystal get 80,000? Mattis mumbled something about how the president had to weigh options. Finally, Mattis said, "You know, I can't give you a good answer, other than we thought that was probably sufficient." "Were you trying to make it fair for the enemy?" she asked. There was no anger in her voice, just sorrow, as if the wounds of the loss would never heal. All of a sudden, the father became engaged and looked directly at Mattis, an unforgettable look. "We certainly weren't trying to do that," Mattis answered defensively. "We've studied you," said the mother. "We've read all the things you've done. Mattis was not the problem. We know you're trying to be loyal." The father stood and shook Mattis's hand, holding it for what seemed like 30 seconds, straining for some connection. The mother, cultured, refined, proper, educated, had one final thought about Washington. "General, no one in that town back there gives a fuck what our family lost."